We'll call the Senate Tax Committee to order Thursday, March 27, 2014. We are going to start this morning with Senator Saxhog as a couple of bills. Senator Saxhog, I'm going to start with the first one on the agenda, Senate File 1849, or do you care?
That'd be just fine, Mr.
Senate
Chair.
Senate File 1849. Welcome, Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1849 would prevent the city of Cohasset and other cities that host power plants from losing significant tax capacity. The sliding scale exclusion is a little-used property tax tool that offers a market value exclusion for electric generation facilities, though the statute implies that the exclusion is for non-utility-owned facilities. A few utilities have applied for and have been granted the exclusion. With me today is Amanda Duer, lobbyist for a coalition of utility cities, and Lauren Solberg, who's representative for Itasca County.
Thank you. Who would you like to, Ms. Duer?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amanda Duer, representing the Coalition of Utility Cities, which is an organization of seven cities that host power plants. First, I'm going to provide a brief background on the sliding scale exclusion. It was originally passed into law back in 1996 for a specific cogeneration project for coke refineries. And the statute 272.0211 is worded pretty generally. The efficiency and market value exclusion rates were then updated in 2005. And like Senator Saxhog said, the owner or operator of the electric generation facility can apply for an 8% market value exclusion for every point of efficiency the plant operates above 40%. And though the statute implies that the exclusion is for non-utility-owned facilities and cogeneration projects, over time, utilities have applied for and been granted the sliding scale exclusion. The application is made with the Department of Revenue, which then asks the Department of Commerce to determine the efficiency of the facility. I provided committee members with a copy of the memo from the Department of Commerce, which acknowledges that the governing statute implies that the sliding scale exclusion is for non-utilities. I'm going to read some excerpts from this document. The emphasis on cogeneration projects is apparent from subdivision 1 of the statute. Also, the language of similar projects have been analyzed and received exemptions in the past. I've also included a staff analysis from the Public Utilities Commission, which must sign off on the sale of electricity in the facilities that receive the sliding scale exclusion, which also questioned whether facilities directly owned by a utility meet the qualifications for the sliding scale exclusion. Staff determined that, based on the review of the statute and legislative history, there is not a clear indication that the exemption was intended to apply to situations where utilities owned the generating facility. However, again, based on general intent, the project was eventually approved. The bill before you is being brought forward as a preemptive measure. In the past, it's often when plants have been converted from coal to natural gas that utilities have applied for the sliding scale exclusion. Currently, the Boswell plant in Cohasset and Laskin plants in Hoyt Lakes are undergoing coal to natural gas conversions. For other natural gas facilities receiving the exclusion, the efficiency has measured around 49%. That ends up being 72% of the market value that is excluded from the local property tax. Other taxing jurisdictions, such as counties and school districts, would also negatively be affected by this exclusion, resulting in the tax burden being shifted to other home and business properties. For these reasons, and because the sliding scale exclusion is arguably not being applied in a way that reflects the original legislative intent, the Coalition of Utility Cities is proposing that only projects currently receiving it continue to be eligible for the exclusion, and that the sliding scale exclusion not be offered for future projects.
We aren't raising taxes on anyone with this proposal because the current exclusions could stay into place. We're simply trying to protect the budgets of the cities that host these power plants from losing a significant portion of their tax base. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dewar.
And Mr. Chair?
Yep.
I just make one slight correction. The Alaskan plant in Aurora Hoyt Lakes is being converted from coal to gas. The Boswell plant in Cohasset is going under a very large efficiency project, but it isn't from coal to gas. It's staying as coal, just becoming very efficient.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Peters? Mr. Peters?
Chair and members
identify yourself for the
of the
record,
committee.
Please.
My name is Max Peters, and I'm the finance director for the city of Cohasset. The Minnesota Power Boswell plant is our city's largest property taxpayer, making up 53% of Cohasset's levy. One of four units at the plant is currently being converted from coal to natural gas. The city of Cohasset is concerned that the utility will seek the sliding scale exclusion after the conversion has been completed. With such a large percentage of our city's tax base tied to the Boswell plant, an exclusion of 72% of the facility's market value, like has been granted after other conversions, would be detrimental to our tax capacity and almost to an amount to almost a $4 million loss. Obviously, everyone wants power plants to operate as efficiently as possible, but this exclusion was never meant to apply to utilities. If it were used in Cohasset or any number of other cities hosting a plant that is being converted, it would have a disastrous effect on city finances. I ask that you please support this bill and discontinue offering the sliding scale exclusion in the future.
Thank you. Questions, members? Seeing none, Mr. Solberg.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Lauren Solberg. I'm a lobbyist for representing Itasca County. Itasca County, obviously, is extremely concerned also about their evaluation of their property tax base. The Minnesota Power plant in Cohasset is based also in Itasca County, and we are fully supportive of this legislation. Again, I was around when we did the 1996 bill. I can remember some of the debate, and it was targeted at that time Coke Refinery. It's been refined, and again, I would repeat that what the staff of the PCA has concluded that it's unclear, and it was not the intent of the legislature at the time to have this type of exclusion or sliding fees, based on for public utilities. So with that, I'm here to support this measure.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Mr. Lotog and Mr. Evans.
We're going to pass, Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Anything else, Senator Saxog? Anybody else wish to testify on Senate File 1849? Members, I think clearly this doesn't impact any current exemptions, just not allowing any changes in the future.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Seeing none, Chair will lay Senate File 1849 over for possible inclusion. Senator Saxog, Senate File 1724.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. 1724 is, and I do have an A1 amendment. You should, author's amendment, like to have adopted. It provides some technical changes that make the bill easier to administer for the Department of Administration.
Senator Saxog has an A1 author's amendment that's in your packet, members. Senator Senjum, move the A1 amendment. Senator Senjum moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendments adopted. Senator Saxog, the bill in the order you want.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1724 is very straightforward. It asks the Department of Revenue to notify both cities and counties when utilities apply for certain property tax exemptions or exclusions. As I represent a city, City of Cohasset, that hosts a power plant that is undergoing a conversion where these property tax benefits may be utilized, I want to be sure that the city and the county have this information for financial planning and budget purposes. With me today is Amanda Dewar, lobbyist for the Coalition of Utility Cities, and Max Peters, financial administrator for the City of Cohasset, to help explain the bill and answer any questions.
Ms. Dewar.
Thank you. Amanda Dewar, again, representing the Coalition of Utility Cities. And like Senator Saxhog said, this bill is just pretty common sense. Equipment that is used for pollution control or abatement is exempt from the property tax. Utilities will notify the Department of Revenue of this equipment's installation and apply for the exemption. Currently, under practice, after the application is processed and the exemption is granted by the Department of Revenue, the department notifies the host county of the property tax exemption. We're simply asking that this information also be shared with the host city, since such an exemption obviously has a property tax implication for them as well. And we're also asking that both the city and county also be notified at the time of application, so that these hosting jurisdictions know that a potential impact to their property tax base may be coming. It will help cities with their budgeting and long-term planning. This notice would only have to be sent when the facility is applying for the exemption for new equipment, the original application, not every time their permit is renewed. So this would not pose an administrative burden upon the department. We're also asking that notification be sent to cities and counties when utilities apply for and are granted the sliding scale exclusion in the event that the other bill takes a different course. This tool provides an 8% market value exclusion for every point of efficiency the plant operates above 40%. Again, this exclusion has significant impact on the tax capacities of the host counties and cities, so this information should be relayed to them. Because of the infrequency of the sliding scale exclusion's use, only 6 facilities have used it since first adopted in 1996. Sending this information would not be burdensome to administered by the Department of Revenue. This is just a common sense reform that would help jurisdictions that host power plants impacts of potentially hundreds of millions of dollars to their tax base, and I urge your support.
Thank you, Ms. Dewar. Mr. Peters.
My name is Max Peters. I'm the finance director for the City of Cohasset. The Minnesota Power Boswell plant located in our city is undergoing a conversion from coal to natural gas. As this conversion is completed, installation of new equipment will affect the total market value and tax capacity of the facility. However, for financial planning and budgeting purposes, it would be very helpful to be notified if and when the utility is applying for either a pollution control exemption or the sliding scale exclusion. These plants make up a large portion of host cities' levies. Receiving prior notice of future changes to the market value would help plan for revenue volatility. It is a good policy to notify the jurisdictions that would be impacted by the exclusion or exemption of hundreds of millions of dollars of utility property value. I ask that you please support this bill.
Thank you. Questions, members? There is one more testifier, Mr. Evans. Well, Senator Saxhog, I know we've had conversations about this in the past, and I would just want to remind the committee that these pollution control costs that the companies are being exempted from are all being borne by the host community. And from my perspective, they should be borne more broadly than that. But that's not what the request is here. It's simply being asking for notification when these are taking place of the host community. I think this is the least we can do in this area. Senator Senjum.
Mr. Chair and Senator Saktog, if this is a good idea, would not the school district also have an interest in knowing about these kind of things?
Senator Saktog.
Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum, I would agree. As a practical matter, I think they will be up in my area, but I understand what you're getting at, and I would say absolutely. The county, and for that matter, a county, too.
What? I'm sorry. I thought the county was in.
Ms. Dewar may have a...
I certainly, the Coalition of Utility Cities would have no problem with that. I just think that would be a question of administrability with the Department of Revenue. If that's something that the committee is interested in, perhaps.
Senator Saxog, I'll leave it to you. We think we can do an oral amendment to include the school district, if you'd like.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to do an oral amendment to include school districts as well as counties.
Mr. Sylvia, would you read the potential oral amendment?
Mr. Chair and members, it would be off of the A1 amendment on line, page 1, line 30. We would strike the word and insert a comma. After the word officer, insert a comma, and then insert and school district, so that the line would read, notification of the order to the county assessor, city finance officer, and school district of the jurisdictions that host the facility.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rust.
In the first two instances, it's actual people. I wonder if we could say school district superintendent to have a person named. Mr. Sylvia?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rust, I think that would make sense. But I should note that the same language is kind of repeated in all three of the sections, so that we would have to essentially do an oral amendment for each of the three sections to include notification for all of those.
Then, Mr. Chairman, I would move that we insert after officer a comma, and after that insert and school district superintendent in all three instances.
Senator Rest moves the oral amendment. Any questions, members? Do we need to read it again? No? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Anything else, members? Anybody else wish to testify on Senate File 1724 as amended? Seeing none, thank you, Senator Saxog.
Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. Over. Thank you, Senator Rest and Senator Senjum. Thanks for the idea. It's a good idea.
Sure. Chair will lay over Senate File 1724 as amended for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Senator Jensen has time constraints. Okay, Senator Jensen.
Here.
Welcome to the Tax Committee, Senator Jensen, Senate File 2399.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for taking the time to hear this bill. I do have a small technical amendment. It's the A4, and it just makes some changes to the legal description of the property that we'll be referring to.
First
it's
stop.
Not the first stop.
Not the first stop. So,
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Rest.
I'll move the amendment.
Senator Rest moves the A4 amendment. It's being passed out, members. Appears to be a clarification of the legal description of the parcel.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Any questions, members? Seeing none, Senator Rest renews her motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. The A4 is adopted. Senator Jensen.
In 1963, the section that we're looking at was created to put into place District 1 Hospital, but some of the language prevents the hospital district from being able to sell. Things have changed since then, and the District 1 Hospital doesn't have the ability to change quickly with the time, and so this bill clears a legislative roadblock that's in place currently and is needed so that the transition can take place. Ultimately, this is about ensuring that the people of Faribault have a local hospital long into the future. This bill makes that more likely. I have with me Stephen Pribble, who is the administrator at the hospital.
Mr. Pribble, welcome to the Tax Committee. Identify yourself for the record.
Yes, I'm Steve Pribble, Chief Executive Officer of District 1 Hospital. Mr. Chair and committee members, first I want to thank Senator Jensen for her leadership, advocacy, and support. In addition, I'd like to acknowledge Dr. Richard Berge, Vice Chair of the District 1 Hospital Board of Directors, and Glenn Holman, Board Member, who are here with us today. In addition, Dan McGinty from Alina Health is also here. As Senator Jensen said, our existing enabling legislation does not allow the local district hospital board to sell, lease, or otherwise transfer the management, control, or operation of the hospital. Senate File 2399 would make that possible. In early 2011, we completed comprehensive strategic planning. We determined through our planning process that the concept of integrated, that is, working together for the benefit of our patients, is essential to providing comprehensive, seamless care. We further determined that the best match for District 1 Hospital is Allina Health. Allina has been in the Faribault community for almost 20 years, providing primary and specialty care. And since 2009, Allina has been serving as our primary hospitalist medical staff, taking care of the hospitalized patients. We have multiple partnerships already in place with Allina, and the most recent being a very successful cancer center in affiliation with Virginia Piper Cancer Institute. As other district hospitals, we have had a tax levy in place. Our legal counsel has researched the question and concluded that once operations and assets are transferred away from the district can no longer invoke its taxing authority. Since we announced our letter of intention to discuss our future with Allina, we've hosted over 25 staff and community forums where we described our vision, provided the background that led us to that vision, and described the steps necessary to get there. Although curious about what the future holds, the general response has been supportive and positive. Our board, composed of 9 community members, our chief of staff, and myself, have done our homework. We have completed our analysis and confidently believe integration will solidify the future of health care in Faribault. I ask for your support and happy to answer any questions.
Senator Rest.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. A question for Senator Jensen. I note on the revenue estimate that this transfer of authority would take away the $440,000 levy. Do you have any assurance that would actually happen, or would the levy continue somewhere else, or is this a special levy? What kind of assurances will the taxpayers have that the city will not just transfer this property tax, raise property taxes for some other reason and be able to tell the taxpayers that your taxes aren't going up? They might not be going down, but they're not going up. What kind of assurances do you have that that's not going to happen?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Jensen.
Senator Rest, Mr. Pribble would like to address that.
Okay.
Mr. Pribble.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, committee members, the tax levy that is in place for District 1 Hospital is unique and specific to District 1 Hospital. It was written into our enabling legislation, and very specifically, the language, yes, I was going back to our enabling legislation, talking about the tax levy. Expenses of acquisition, betterment, administration, operation, and maintenance of any hospital operated by the hospital district shall be paid from the revenue derived therefrom and to the extent necessary from ad valorem taxes levied by the hospital board. So it's a District 1 hospital specific tax levy that is administered via the county. As I mentioned earlier, legal counsel has researched it, and because the tax levy is directed at operations of the hospital, once operations of the hospital are transferred away, there's nothing to tax to. So there's the taxing authority disappears. It dissolves.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Pribble, I understand the intention. What I want to know is, what are the property taxpayers going to see on their truth and taxation notice? Are they going to see countywide or however it's imposed, but where the district hospital levy is stated? First of all, is it separately stated on their property taxes? And I wouldn't like to see it supplanted and just the other taxing districts tax $440,000 and people, instead of seeing a reduction, see a level playing field and maybe don't pay any attention. I mean, where is it on the truth in taxation statement? Is this next one, if this goes through, going to say zero with an asterisk saying this levy is now set aside? You understand?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Rest. I worked very closely with counsel on this because
Senator
I wanted
Jensen.
To ensure that the taxpayer had that
information
so that they would be able to do that. So part of this legislation on 2.30 to 2.34, the reason we added this section is because that particular thing is part of the sale, and so that the District 1 Hospital Board would still be in effect until all requirements of the sale have been met. And that is part of that.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, I'm not being clear.
Senator Rust.
Is there a separate line on the truth and taxation notice and on
yes,
the property tax notice for this particular levy?
Yes, there
and
is.
Senator Jensen.
And will it, Mr. Chairman, Senator
Rust.
Jensen, and will it continue and show zero so that and if the other categories go up by that much, then the taxpayers will say, what happened here?
Mr.
Senator
Chair,
Jensen.
Senator Rust, the taxpayer will be able to see on their tax statement the reflection of if this sale goes into effect and that levy is taken care of. They will be able to see that.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Rust, this plan for this bill was to go to the floor. Mm-hmm. I think that with the questions you brought up, perhaps we should talk to the county and we can move this at a later date to the floor if it needs to go that way. I also would plan on including it in the Senate tax bill if we get answers to the questions. But for now, perhaps we should lay this over.
Mr. Chairman, I want to make sure that I'm not belaboring a point here, but I want to make sure that the taxpayers don't see on their bottom line, okay, you know, the things are this year and last year. And then this year, let's say one taxpayer pays the whole thing, $440,000. Next year, zero. But other levies have gone up $440,000. Value stayed the same. And all of a sudden, the tax is the same. They should see a tax reduction. And I don't know how you legislate that, but I think there need to be some assurances. And I note that this bill in the House has gone separately. It's on the floor, as I understand it, and did not go to the tax committee. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Senator Jensen.
But I do think this is a taxpayer issue, and I'm happy to move it to the floor, but I appreciate your caution, and maybe we should just keep it here a little bit longer and get an answer.
Senator Jensen, would that be okay? We'll be back in committee Monday morning. Let us look at this tomorrow and over the weekend, and we will very likely move this to the floor for Monday's session.
And Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Rust.
And I would be happy to do that on your behalf without you having to come back to the committee if we're in a crunch for time, if we get the answer.
Okay, Mr. Chair and Senator Rust, I just want to know what we need to provide to you so that you can take a look at this. Is there something that we need that you don't currently have to be able to make that determination?
And Senator Jensen, Ms. McQuay has just informed me that this is a revenue generator. We will have problems moving this to the floor on its own.
Because it Mr. Chairman, Senator Jensen, because the, assuming that the tax goes down, it means the homeowner property tax refunds also go down by some $20,000. And so it is a revenue raiser and couldn't, and I don't know how it's on the floor of the House.
Okay.
We'll work on this, Senator.
It's on the floor of the House because it's a House, you know, the House file can do that, but the Senate files cannot.
Any other questions, members? Senator Sanjum.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Senator Jensen or your witness. Does the authorization of this by the legislature infer that we're going to transfer this hospital, or at least the hospital elects to be transferred to a specific new organization, or would any organization, be it Mayo, be it Samford, be it anybody else interested in being a partner with this existing hospital have the option to do that? In other words, I guess, does it specifically direct the sale to Alina?
Mr. Prill?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sanjum, committee members, no, it does not specify to whom the district board may choose to transfer assets and operations. I refer to Alina because in our strategic planning process and so on, that became the best fit, if you will.
Sure.
And we did announce that we were in discussions with Alina back in November.
Okay.
So it's a bit of a parallel process, but the bill itself is generic relative to the destination.
Okay. And so, Mr. Chair, so that's that option is completely up to the Board of Directors.
Mr. Pribble.
Is that true?
Mr. Chair, Senator Senchum, and committee members, yes, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
And Senator Jensen, I want to assure you that we're not trying to hold this up. My county hospital, Clearwater County Hospital, just went through a sale this last year. Mm-hmm. I understand how hard this is for communities. I understand that this is difficult, but you're working for the long-term good of your community to provide quality health care. We really, truly understand that, and we're going to work to make sure that happens, but we have these questions that we need to resolve.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's why we did work really hard with council to make sure that we get this right, not only procedurally, but for the taxpayers within the district.
Yeah. Anything else, members? Senator Rest.
Thank you. And I don't know the law in this, but is the sale to a private hospital, is it precluded from being a for-profit hospital as opposed to a private hospital? I mean, a nonprofit. How does that work in Minnesota with this kind of sale? Just curious.
Mr. Pribble.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, committee members, as I understand it, healthcare organizations in Minnesota are compelled to be not-for-profit. Allina is an example. Mayo is an example. Are not-for-profit organizations. So
just wanted that reassurance when he mentioned a for-profit organization that this is the sale must go to a nonprofit in Minnesota. Thank you.
Anybody else wish to testify on Senate File 2399? Any other questions, members? Thank you. We will work with you, Senator Jensen, to get these questions answered and move this forward. So,
okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair
lays over. Senate File 2399 as amended for possible inclusion. Thank you, Mr. Pribble. Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate File 1958, I'll give you a little background and explain what we're trying to do here in Scott County and Helena Township. Scott County is supporting an initiative from Helena Township to expand the number of units which can be connected to the Cedar Lake Area Water and Sanitary Sewer District. Currently, the district is allowed by state law 325 connections, and these are all connected through a sanitary sewer trunk line to the wastewater treatment facility in the city of New Prague. Helena Township is requesting that 39 additional connections be allowed to service a development within its township. The township supervisor there, who could not make it today, said the township had to take over responsibility for what was supposed to be a community septic system for the 39-lot Silver Maple Bay Estates development, and when the developer went bankrupt, so they took over that. Currently, there are only a few homes built in the development, and rather than proceed with maintaining a very expensive community septic system or having each home put in its own, they wanted to connect them to the current pipeline in New Prague. The city of New Prague has recently built a new wastewater treatment plant. They have the capacity to take on the extra connections, and they've agreed to do so. Also, the Metropolitan Council's Division of Environmental Services has already sent a letter to the townships indicating its support for the hookups. Section 2 of the bill does say that if the district is removed, and which on approval from the governing body, the Cedar Lake Area and Water Sanitation District, and after all obligations are paid in full, the town board may vote to sell or use surplus property or the surplus of tax revenues or services charged collected from the district to connect the property owners in the former district to, in this case, the New Prague system. Any surplus not used to connect residents may be distributed equally to property owners in the former district that were charged the extra tax or service fee during the most recent tax year. Any surplus not refunded must be transferred to the town's general fund. By the way, there's probably not going to be any surplus. For your information, I think the 8 acres we're talking about was recently valued at $32,000 total, and it's probably going to cost more than $90,000 to retrofit. But that is the bill. I don't know if Claire Roebling is here. She's also kind of the expert in this area, but has me to bring this bill on behalf of Scott County and the townships. But I will stand for any questions.
Well, thank you, Senator Dahl. And you mentioned the reason you're here is because normally that extra money, if there was any, would go back to the individual connectors. You're proposing to have the connections paid for out of there, and then if there is any surplus from that, that it would go to the general fund. Everybody that is involved in this is supportive of what you're proposing, I gathered from your resolutions of support.
Mr. Chair, yes, and we have support and from New Prague, from Helena Township, from Scott County. They're all supportive of this.
Senator Ress?
Yeah, that was my question. Do we have copies of those resolutions?
I do not have them in my packet.
Okay. But they did take place. That's all I'm asking.
Well, Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, I do have resolutions if you wanted to look at them from the townships, the city of New Prague.
I think, Mr. Chairman, as long as you have them there, yeah. I think we can. I don't have any questions.
Council.
I just want to make sure. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Any questions, members? Anybody else wish to testify on Senate File 1958? Seeing none, thank you, Senator.
Never mind. No.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. We will lay Senate File 1958 over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Carlson. Senator Rosen. Senator Rosen, Senate File 2171.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning to you all. This is a good story, Mr. Chair, members. This is about a city in my district, Jackson, that I just acquired through redistricting, and there is it is an amazing city that's going on. So this bill basically is increasing their tax abatement to $300,000, which right now it's $200,000, or 10% of the city's net tax capacity where the abatement applies. But I just want to just go back and talk a little bit about why this is so unique and why they are asking for an increase on their amount. With me, I have Sue Persick from the city. And this city has got a major employer that has got all these ancillary businesses springing off from that. It is moving and shaking. It's about, 10 miles from the Iowa border or so, right along I-90. And it's an amazing success story. And I think what's amazing about it is the whole entire city pitches in. It's very, very, very active. But recently we held a town hall meeting down there, and three of the commissioners from MnDOT, from Deed, and from Housing came and spoke and listened to what was going on from all the active members from the police, the city council, the school, and they walked away amazed at what is happening in Jackson. I do have a handout, and it shows the municipal utility and city news. I just want to point out their 2012 level for tax abatements. They're bumping up towards the max, which is probably really, excuse me, really unusual for a town of this size for 2013 and 2012. And I do want to point out there's a little bit of, if you look at the river restoration that they're doing, there's the Des Moines River that runs through there, $45,000 for each year. So they have some economic development, a plan, a mission. They are very successful at this because of ACCO, ECHM, and all, like I said, all the ancillary businesses that are springing up because of that. And so they are asking for a higher level for tax abatement. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Ms. Persick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Can I just ask?
Senator Rosen.
Senator Rest, I'm sorry. Is that, I noticed on the second page that there are the, there's a narrative for the projects. Is there one for that river restoration project that I'm just missing, going over it very quickly?
Mr. Rosen. Chair and Senator Rest, I was looking that for that too, but no, I don't think there is. No.
Okay, so maybe we could have a little bit, Mr. Chairman, Senator Rosen and ma'am, maybe we could have just a little bit more information about that project.
To the testifier, I apologize, I didn't catch your name. Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
My name is Susan Persig. I am the Economic Development Coordinator for the City of Jackson, Minnesota.
Ms. Persig.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jackson is a very unique community in the way of business development. There are about 3,300 people in Jackson, and we have over 2,000 people working in our industrial park. So we are a regional, we make a regional impact with the jobs that are created and have a lot of people commuting in from as far away as 50 miles one way to work in our manufacturing plants and businesses in our industrial park. Your question, Senator Rest, about the river restoration project, that was a project that was completed about 3 years ago. So it was funded through abatement of taxes of the downtown retail and service businesses so that they could use that funding to pay the bonds for the project. They removed a low-head dam from the river that was a hazard, a drowning hazard, and replaced it with rocks and rapids in the river. And it's a very nice change, but it is not an economic development project. The other projects are, in my mind, economic development projects where jobs are created and in a lot of cases, dilapidated buildings are removed and new buildings are built, and that's been a very positive thing for us.
Ms. Persig, does the City of Jackson also use tax increment financing, and what percentage of your tax base is in TIF?
You know, I'm sorry, I can't answer that question, what percent is in TIF. We do use TIF. And we use abatement. We have a revolving loan fund.
Mr. Chairman, you use all the
Senator
tools.
Is
that every correct? Tool, but we can't use abatement right now because we're maxed out on the capacity.
Mr. Chair, just FYI, I've never had this in my Senate district. Their biggest issue right now is housing. They cannot find appropriate housing for the workers that are coming in from Iowa, and as Ms. Persig said, in the surrounding counties. I mean, this is a major hub, economic hub, and they have a lot more planned ongoing. Of course, they can't talk about that as far as, you know, what is being planned, but or the projects, I should say, but there is a lot going on, and it is all ag-based, which is very exciting also.
Senator Rosen, we've had a number of provisions come to the committee this year dealing with housing and the difficulty of market-rate housing in rural Minnesota. It's a pretty tough nut to crack, but we're working on it. My question for Ms. God, I'm so terrible with
Persig.
Names this
Persig.
Morning.
Persig.
Persig. These tax abatements and TIF districts that you currently have, are any of those set to expire anytime in the near future?
We have a chart showing when they expire, and I meant to bring it, did not. I'm sorry. I believe the first of these to expire is 2016, and then there's another couple years where another one expires. They're spread out enough so that they don't all go away for a number of years.
Sure. Well, the concern is that this general law was increased in 2008 from 10% of levy to 10% of net tax capacity, which was an increase, and this would be, you know, another significant increase for the City of Jackson. We don't want to get in the way of your job creation and your business expansion, but there is risk in this. I mean, these businesses have costs, and there is cost to provide services. And we'll maybe a little information on when these current TIFs and abatements are going to expire would be helpful as we contemplate this. We are going to lay this over for possible inclusion, so we do have a little time to get some of these questions answered.
I'd like to see that information.
We would, yeah.
And Mr. Senator Rest. Mr. Chairman, particularly besides the description of the TIF districts and the timeline, I am interested in knowing how much of the tax base has been committed to tax increment, and I'm sure that's in your the reports. I don't think you have to make it up. Our do any research. It's just in, it's in some of the reports that are already made by the city.
And Senator Ress, it looks, unless I'm reading this wrong, it looks like the tax abatements are 15% of the tax levy collectible in 2014.
And that's pretty high.
That's pretty high in
Mr.
itself,
Chairman,
and so levy TIF is on top of that. Senator
Ress. And the reason for that is so that the city doesn't get into trouble with its tax abatements and capturing property tax base in delivering essential services. Mm-hmm. And then if they have to raise the general levy on everybody else, including the homeowners, then is there a net benefit there or not? And I think the city, you know, has to discuss that with itself and its legislators to as to whether that benefit is, and maybe for the short term, maybe for the long term, is to the taxpayers again, and whoever else is going to bear that burden. And it may not, it may be a net zero. I mean, it may be that the benefit to the city and its taxpayers is realized right away, even with the abatement, because of additional housing and commerce in the city and all of that. But I think that has to be a self-analysis that we're interested in, so that the city doesn't get itself into trouble by giving away its taxes and not being able to afford that extra police officer that it may need, and then what do they do?
Okay. And Senator Rosen, perhaps if you have a specific project in mind, which I'm assuming you do, and there's a timeliness issue to this, perhaps we could look at that and what the needs are for that specific project and narrow this up just a little bit also. It might be helpful.
That would be great, Mr. Chair, and I will certainly get the information for you. I do want to say, though, that the one thing that came
Senator
out of
Rosen.
This town hall meeting with the three commissioners is that it's not right to talk about issues just in one silo, because these are all moving pieces, especially out in greater Minnesota. What's good for Jackson is good for Worthington, is good for Fairmont, even good for Mankato. I mean, these are large distances, but they've got so much going on there because of this industry that they have momentum on, that one of these missing pieces, whether it's housing or the tax abatement or, you know, too high property taxes or a school system that their school system is amazing. This is going to, everything could falter. So this committee, this community is so committed to moving all together, whether it is law enforcement or economic development. It's truly, it was amazing. I think the commissioners were very, very impressed after that town hall meeting. But we certainly will get all the information that we need to get to you, because it's a wonderful success story.
And Senator Rosen, I recall when the city officials were up here talking about the AGCO coming to Jackson.
Right.
I mean, it's a huge success story. I understand there's a lot of stuff going on.
A lot of stuff.
We're not going to try not to stand your way, but we want to make sure that things are going to work out, too.
Right. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Senator Sanjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I think you and I probably agree on a few things. One of them is our trust in local government officials, and to me, if it works for them, we should make every effort to make it work from our point of view.
Well, Senator Sanjum, we did have a couple of cities here, or one city here, just recently that has problems providing public safety now.
And I understand. Yeah,
they're at the 18% issue, yeah. And they can't levy for police officers, and that's a challenge we're working on. So, we just want to make sure that everything's going to be okay.
Yep.
And Mr. Chair, to that point, to Senator Sanjum's, and thank you, Senator Sanjum, that's a very good point. But Ms. Persick wants to just explain just briefly the relationship between the county, the school, and the city.
Ms. Persick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At a recent request of AGCO for an expansion, this has been about 3 years ago when they did their Massey-Ferguson tractor line brought that into the plant. They requested an abatement from the city, the county, and the school district. And normally school districts are not asked for abatements. We just don't do that. On that occasion, we did ask the school district. The board approved the abatement. And in the superintendent's eyes, it's been the best thing they've done, and they're willing to do another because what it's meant is a lot more students in the school. And they're not they're not actually losing money. They have actually gained money because the number of students has outweighed the abatement that they're making for this project. The county also willingly abated taxes for that project, as did the city. And the understanding is this has such a regional impact that people are working there from all over the county and all over the area that maybe wouldn't have a job because in their community things aren't happening the way they are in Jackson.
Ms. Chenderest.
Thank you. This is a question for Mr. Sylvia. When a school district does abate taxes, does the state in any way fill the hole of that revenue?
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm not sure. If I could look into that and get the answer to you. I'm not sure if there's any sort of
I just want to understand whether it's the taxpayers in the district that are championing the project and willing to have that abatement happen with the school district in particular, rather than saying, well, the state will pick up whatever deficit it is. I just want to make sure. It used to work that way with TIF until we separated it. I want to make sure that it's not happening with abatements.
The concern is that the equalizing factors are based on your net tax capacity. When you abate, your tax capacity goes down. And with the increase in equalizing factors that we've done the last couple of years, is the state picking up that reduction in tax capacity?
Exactly. So we need to be aware of that when the school district says, okay, go ahead, that maybe it's all the rest of the taxpayers in the state that are actually paying for it.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't want to get into this right now, but since you mentioned housing and we've had multiple discussions from other communities in rural Minnesota that they have housing issues, if you have any ideas, if you could share them with Senator Rosen and she could share with us, we'd appreciate that. I'd appreciate that because we're talking with a bunch of people. So,
Mr. Chair, there is that the Challenge Program, I believe it's called, the Challenge Program, which is a match from a local business, and AGCO has met that. But I think we need to put, and it's a state, private match. And that's a wonderful program, but it probably needs a little more attention in that direction too. We just hate to lose these students to Iowa or to North Dakota. And they're working in Minnesota. That's a big problem.
Sure. Well, it's a problem, and we need to be attacking it. And nobody really has come up with the solution yet. But I think we're aware of the issue, and we're really reaching out for good ideas because we don't have it right yet. Anything else, members? Anybody else wish to testify on Senate File 2171? Thank you, Senator Rosen.
Thank
we'll
you
look
very
for
much,
talking with
Mr.
you on
Chair.
Some of these. Chair will lay over Senate File 2171 for possible inclusion. Thank you for traveling today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Senator Carlson. Senate File 1595.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I bring to you Senate File 1595, which is a bill for permissive language to allow cities to collect civil penalties and fines as a special assessment. The city of Burnsville brought this issue to me, along with the city of Lakeville. The city supports enabling legislation that will better empower it to administer property maintenance codes, building codes, zoning codes, health codes, and public safety and nuisance ordinances by including the authority to levy administrative fines. Traditional methods of citation enforcement and prosecution have met with increasing costs and delays in enforcement for local units of government. 1595 authorizes the cities to use the special assessment procedure to collect civil penalties or fees imposed by the city as a result of property-related violations. And again, this is permissive language, and it requires an ordinance to do so. The penalties or fees assessed must be assessed against the property that is the subject of the penalty or the fee. As you probably know, in statute today, there are many situations that can already be assessed against property, things like weed elimination, safety hazards, other items that, again, require ordinance but can be levied against the property.
To that point, Senator Carlson, is there a specific issue that you're trying to address that's not included in the list that you're now proposing this general law for? I think that in the past, when we've looked at these lists, we have tended to try to address the specific issue and not necessarily do a general law change, being that there's already been a fair amount of legislative work done on this list. So is there a specific issue you're trying to address that's not addressed by the list?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and this would be to add to that list the ability to assess civil penalties. These would be fines for a noncompliance of ordinances.
Oh, so it's that. Okay.
So I'm going to ask Mr. Steve Melke, who is the city administrator for Lakeville, to provide some perspective and testimony.
Welcome to the Tax Committee. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Steve Melke, I'm the city administrator for the city of Lakeville. If possible, Mr. Chair, I've got a couple of handouts that perhaps provide some additional background.
We'll get a page.
Thank you. I'm representing a group of cities in the county of Dakota, which have a partnership called the High Impact Partnership, or the HIP Committee. We look for ways in which to create efficiencies and effectiveness in the way we conduct business, and one of the initiatives that we are working on is this ability to utilize an assessment process for the collection of unpaid fines or penalties based on property-related infractions. The method that most statutory cities today use is a criminal prosecution method. In other words, if someone fails to maintain their property or follow city ordinances, we generally are offered only the opportunity to create a criminal prosecution process that takes it through the district court and ultimately ends up as a criminal prosecution. Many of the home rule cities have the authority to use the administrative process and then a collection process for those penalties after it's been reviewed through the assessment of as a lien on properties following the Chapter 429 assessment process. Statute today does not have that authority for statutory cities, so we're looking for that ability. And what that really would accomplish for cities is a much more cost-effective, it's also more cost-effective for the violator to not have to go through the district court process for what are really health and safety issues within neighborhoods. As you're probably aware, the Chapter 429 process involves notification, a hearing before the city council. There's an appeals process after the city council acts to impose an assessment. All of that comes really at the back end of trying to take care of these issues that pop up from time to time in neighborhoods and result in problems within neighborhoods. So our cities have found that this would be an effective way for the resident who has had this code violation imposed and worked on. It also is effective for cities, and I think it's effective for the court systems in trying to take what are really generally minor issues and try to resolve them in an administrative fashion. So with that, I can stand for any questions.
Questions, members? So, Senator Dietzick.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I represent City of Minneapolis, and they're a home rule charter, so I just did confirm we do this. And I would say that they're not always minor problems. Some of these problems, they're livability problems, but if it's your house that's next door or it's your block, I have a problem property on the one block, and they have had, I think the fines are, they can be up to $12,000 because it's just, they just are not doing anything, and they were throwing mattresses outside, and so they had to have, you know, a lot of extra pickup. And if you're the house next door, you know, not only does your property values go down, but it just becomes, you know, it's the broken window syndrome. And so I understand what they're going through, and it is a problem. It's not, I think it would be more efficient to go through the city than through the courts. It's not going to solve all the problems, because I can attest, have, you know, being from Minneapolis where we have this ability right now and we're using it, it is helpful, it is efficient, and it keeps that out of the courts. And I would say they're not always minor problems, because they do add up. It's usually not just, you know, they get a citation to fix the weeds. And when I do it in my city, you know, they're no longer mowing at ankle level. They're, you know, it's thigh high. And so, you know, they don't take them lightly. They don't, you know, continually overburden the person. I mean, these are things that they try to work with the people as much as possible to get them to maintain their property. And some of them are just abandoned, and some of them are just people with, they have, you know, clearly have some other issues, and just others just avoid it. And so I would be supportive of this, just because it has worked in other areas. So that's my comment.
Thank you, Senator Dietzick. And maybe Senator Carlson, your testifier, or Mr. Milky. So is there a degree of problems that this would apply to? I mean, you're not considering people not shoveling their sidewalks, I assume. And is there some kind of limit on what these civil penalties could go to, or how do you determine the level of civil penalty? I'm not familiar with this.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Milky.
The creation of this is by a city ordinance. It would be up to the city council to determine which violations they wish to use this process on. And the penalty imposed is also set by local officials. So the city council would have that that ability to establish the amounts.
Okay, thank you. So there are any other questions, members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sanjum.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm just trying to think through this as it's written. And certainly as a city official, we've experienced these kind of issues as well, dilapidated houses with almost junkyard front yards, backyards, and so on and so forth. But as it's written, would the city impose the civil penalty first and then do a city-invoked cleanup with a special assessment second? I mean, would we double-hit this property owner?
Mr. Milky.
Or would that be a city option?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sanjum, that would be I guess the easiest way to say is it's a city option. The city, in establishing the administrative process, would be able to determine whether they wish to go through the fine process. To actually do the cleanup itself would require additional actions. This system alone would not allow the city to go onto the property and take care of the problem. It would simply be a tool to try and entice the property owner to make the improvement and to fix the problem that's in place. The tool would also, in most cities, I know, if it's not effective as a way of resolving it, the criminal process is still an option. And in fact, as the Dakota County cities have talked about it, we would make that an option for the property owner right up front to choose which method of dealing with this that they wish to go for. So if they're not interested in the administrative process, then they could go to the criminal process and go through the court system as an option. But this really isn't about the process. It's more around how do we collect that fine if in fact they have not taken care of the issue.
And members, okay. There are two people that wish to testify on my list. Mr. Selensen, I'm not going to get that right, and Ms. Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Kiselishin.
Kiselishin, very good.
Yeah, that's I blame my parents for that. Mr. Chairman, I have a handout. If I could get somebody on staff to distribute that, that'd be appreciated.
Sure, we'll get a page.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members, my name is John Kiselishin. I'm currently the owner of a legal newspaper in Anoka County. I also work as a political consultant. Previously, I served 4 years as mayor of Roseville, where I established the highly successful residential property maintenance enforcement program that has been in use for the past 12 years. Now, I'm here speaking on my own behalf today. Now, I'm speaking against Senate File 1595 for several reasons. Now, the handout here contains the full statute, Minnesota Statutes 429-101. Focusing on the bill, the first lines, 1.12 to 1.17, in my opinion, are overly broad in its reach. I read it as applying to anything imaginable that has some sort of relation to property. I have seen no list detailing the reaches of this bill. Home-based businesses, sidewalk shoveling, all of that would be included. Anything, as it says, property-related. That's a pretty big category. Second, while there is due process through the courts under the current version of 412-231, there is no due process requirement under this newly proposed Section B of 412-231, because this process would not go through the courts. Third, while charter cities such as Minneapolis or Rochester or Llano Lakes may be exercising these powers currently, their powers are subject to initiative and referendum because of charter cities. This bill will not provide the same initiative and referendum safeguards to the citizens of approximately 750 statutory cities this bill would apply to, which would include cities like Burnsville, Lakeville, or Roseville. Fourth, line 1.17's use of Minnesota Statutes 429-101 to assess a fine is an inappropriate use of this chapter of law, in my opinion. Now, current law allows approximately 750 statutory cities to assess cost to properties under 429 for public improvements, services like the operation of a street light system or sidewalk repair, and unpaid charges like a sewer or water bill. Allowing the certification of fines to the property tax through the use of Chapter 429 is inappropriate, and I would argue is a drastic change in tax policy. In reviewing other statutes that allow assessments to properties, I personally was unable to find an instance where a property assessment was a fine. Minnesota Statutes Chapter 88, 89, 103E, 103I, 116A, 145A, 443, 444, all allow assessments to properties. In every instance, there is a value, service, or improvement that's provided associated with those chapters, not a fine. Now, the bill before you only provides you with the language of 429-101 Subdivision 1. The statute actually has three subdivisions, 1, 2, and 3. All three subdivisions apply to this bill. Now, my handout provides you with the full statute, including Subdivisions 1, 2, and 3. And I've attached those three additional statutes which apply to this proposed bill. Those are 429-061, 071, and 081. Now, when you read all the statutes that will apply to this proposal, you will see that fines have no place in Chapter 429 without rewriting other sections of this chapter. For example, 429-081, which would apply to this, is titled Appeal to District Court, which is page 8 in my handout. That section states, quote, "This section provides the exclusive method of appeal from special assessments levied pursuant to this chapter," end quote. Prior to this sentence, it states, quote, "The court shall either affirm the assessment or set it aside and order a reassessment as provided in Section 429-071, Subdivision 2. Now, I reviewed a Court of Appeals case, Bank of America of St. Paul versus the City of Minneapolis, to determine how the court addresses assessments levied pursuant to 429-101. The court stated that the city is exercising its police powers, which means the reasonableness test would be applied. So therefore, there's a comparison made between the dollar amount assessed and the cost of the public improvement service or unpaid charge, like a sewer and water bill. Now, if they match, the court affirms the assessment. If they don't match, then the court simply has the authority to return it back to the governing body for another reassessment. So I cannot see how a fine, which provides no benefit to a property, could apply to this process under Chapter 429, yet it does, and it will. Now, the fact that it can take over a year for an action under 429.101 to show up on a property tax bill further demonstrates that fines have no place in Chapter 429. Allowing the assessment of fines under 429, in my opinion, makes no sense. It is a brand new application to this chapter, which, in my opinion, would require a complete review and rewriting of the chapter. I mean, if a city charter happens to mention certifying fines with Chapter 429, and I'm sure there are some out there that do, it doesn't mean it's an appropriate application of the law or that it makes sense. Now, I applaud those who wish to clean up problem properties. In Roseville, we have successfully used property abatement under 429.101, Subdivision 1A3. Our process is up to 10 times faster and more efficient than the old system of issuing fines. Another option, a more appropriate option for this proposal, may be to modify 484.013, which allows for the creation of a housing court in any county. Now, 484.013 is the last two pages of my packet. Now, I'd like to mention that in Roseville, we do not use the courts in most situations. Roseville, or I should say Lakeville, like Roseville, already has the right to go onto properties and clean them up under existing law. And that's exactly what we do in Roseville. We don't mess around. We deal with problem properties. We call people before the city council for a hearing. They have an opportunity to state their case. In most cases, they do not show up. We direct city staff to take whatever actions are necessary to fix a roof on a house, clean up garbage and debris, and whatever it may be, and then we assess that work to the property tax. So there's a value in exchange for the work that's done. We don't fool around with the tickets. We don't threaten people. We simply get the work done. And we do it efficiently. We do it at a good cost. And, in fact, we have many property owners that actually sign agreements agreeing to this process because they need help curing a problem. And sometimes the city can step in and help. We do all of that under existing law. We don't need any special new laws, special legislation, or anything to do that today. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so one of my questions that I'm going to ask for whoever up there, so in the city of Minneapolis, we do have, I mean, we're a home rule charter, so home rule charter city, so we can do this, and we do this. But my understanding is, and I have their, you know, up on the website here, they do have a whole due process so that if you get a fine, you know, you can contest it, and I believe you can even contest the special assessments, and so they have the due process laid out. And so I, you know, would ask, I'll just call you Mr. K, if you know, they have this special process set up, is that something that would work? And then to staff, if, you know, if it doesn't belong, you know, do they believe it belongs in this section 429, or is there another section that they could move this to? So, because I do agree that you do need due process, and Minneapolis has the due process, and they don't, and I do believe we actually, you can get assessed a fine in Minneapolis for not shoveling your sidewalk. Again, they don't, you know, we just don't have the time and the people to go out and if there's a, you know, 2-inch snowfall, and they don't go out that day. You know, it's usually, again, when it's a foot high or 3 feet high and you clearly haven't shoveled all winter long, then you do get an assessment. And Minneapolis does have a process where you get notified, and within a certain time frame, if you don't do it, then we do have a process set up where the city contracts out to do it, and then that gets added to your special assessment. You can pay the fine, and then it does end up on your tax bill. And again, in Minneapolis, some of these special assessments have gotten as high as, you know, I'm aware of at least a few that are $12,000. And so, you know, and I'll ask Mr. Milkey, you know, is there, have you considered the process to give people due process and set this up through an ordinance? And then, you know, asking Mr. Kay, is this something that you think that if they had a due process set up would work?
Senator Dietzick, who do you want first, Mr. Kay or Mr. Milkey?
Either one of them.
Mr. Kay.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator. First of all, we have to keep in mind that Minneapolis is a charter city. So any process that they do set up is subject to initiative and referendum by the citizens.
We do not have initiative and referendum. You can make a charter amendment, but it is technically not initiative and referendum.
Okay, I'm sorry for Minneapolis, but you do have a charter commission and stuff.
Yeah.
So there is a process outside of the city council where issues like this can be addressed. And with a statutory city, none of that is possible. There is no charter commission. There is no ability for initiative and referendum. It doesn't exist with the 750 charter cities. So that's one difference. Second point is this bill that's before you has no due process requirement. It'd be great if it did, but it doesn't. So there is absolutely, while we may have testifiers that come to the table here and say, we swear that our city will have due process, that doesn't apply to the other 749 cities out there. This bill has no requirement for due process. The current statute does. The new proposal does not. And the current statute does because it goes through the court system under Chapter 412.231. The issue of 429, I don't know what process Minneapolis is using for assessing these particular charges to the property tax. Since they're a charter city, they may be able to create their own process in law that's not connected to a state statute. What I can tell you is when I read through 429 and the various provisions that apply to it, fines do not fit within a chapter of law that is dedicated to dealing with with improvements, like sewer and water bill fee collection, diseased trees, things that where there's a value that's done in exchange for a cost. So maybe there's a different section of law that applies, but as I see it, it's not 429 unless you want to do some serious revising of 429. In my understanding, from my basic research, I think this will be the first time that a fine by a statutory city would be run through the Chapter 429 process.
Mr. Milkey.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, thank you for the question. I'm going to ask Mr. Grindhofer from the League of Cities to come up and answer any specific statutory questions. I don't pretend to be a statutory expert on the 429 process, but I can tell you that as our cities through the process of analyzing this issue, we had people come from Rochester, from Minnetonka, and from Coon Rapids, all of which are utilizing this process as home rule charter cities. Each one of them have two forms of due process. There is the penalty provision in which you're trying to establish whether the violation has existed, which is on the process side. And then there's the 429 process, which has its own appeal process. It has its own hearing process, its own due process in that fashion. So I would suggest that while this isn't addressing the penalty provision side of it, it does address the penalty enforcement.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you. Mr. Milkey, do you know how many cases go to court and how many actually, you know, get to where you're taking up? I mean, our courts are kind of clogged right now, and so how many cases go and how much is this clogging the court? Because I think if we can find, and maybe it doesn't belong in this section, and maybe it needs to go somewhere, and we need to lay out the specific due process. But I think, again, just knowing how clogged our courts are, if you can give us any idea of how much cases go to court, and
Mr. Chair,
that might
Senator,
be helpful.
I can only speak anecdotally. I don't have any statistics. But in the case of Lakeville, very few end up in the court systems because generally we were able to work with people to resolve it before it reaches a point of writing a criminal citation. We would follow that same process. Our goal is to clean up, not to work on penalties. But In the case of Lakeville, anything where we are unable to work with that person, they all go to the criminal court system. So it's we have no other feasible options for getting enforcement. For those home rule cities that we spoke with, they don't have very many opt to go to the criminal court system because they find that this system of administrative process is both friendlier to the violator and a faster and more efficient way of getting it accomplished.
Let's hear from Ms. Lee.
I have handouts.
Not very friendly in Rochester.
Huh?
Not very friendly in Rochester.
We'll get a page. Ms. Lee.
Yes.
You could hardly walk.
Just had that one.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International, which does legal advocacy and public policy. R&R Family Centers, it does shelters, transitional and permanent housing and development and services. And APAC, the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium of Trusted Professionals and Service Providers. I have 50 years in housing-related fields, including having national certifications accepted by the state in foreclosure prevention and intervention. I've been a lender, realtor, and developer, and I've even done my own home from ground up, so I know what all goes into it, and when they talk about buildings and what needs to be fixed up, I'm familiar with that and know what the people need to go through.
And Ms. Lee, yes. If you could pull the mic in and speak up just a little bit. It's hard to hear in this room.
I've worked in legal advocacy and policy for 26 years. The legal advocacy cases are both inside and outside of the courts, have included foreclosure prevention and intervention, evictions, and other housing matters. And I just wanted to mention, because we did have some veterans on this committee, that they did include services for veterans. We are proposing amendments to Senate File 1595 to help homeowners and relative homesteaders get the help that they need to remain in their homes and prevent foreclosure and homelessness. We have worked on cases where we know that the city has information, access to resources available, and sometimes the fund through state and federal funds, but they don't provide it when they give notice of a code violation and notice of the penalties and fees and now use of special assessments whereby they technically can take legal action and it starts counting in any court case against them. Was our proposed legislation. I apologize because we did want it to get it to the senator earlier, but the reviser waited until before the hearing to have it ready, and then it had to be fixed and routed to people, et cetera. So the city has not had time to review it for any changes that they might want. We have added Section C to the penalties under 412.231 on page 1 and on subdivision 4 on page 3.
Ms. Lee, being that amendment is not in front of us.
No, I understand.
And we are going to lay this over for possible inclusion. Maybe we could get that amendment to the Senate author and to the tax committee staff, and we could review it in that manner.
Okay, but I just wanted to provide information related to the issue. Basically, it supports the issue as far as allowing a homeowner and homesteader to have a due process or notice information ahead of time, so it's clearly spelled out what exactly is occurring, because right now, in the cases we've worked on, they just give, you're in violation of the code, we can do this, this, and this to you. And we have seniors who are getting hysterical. They have no help from legal aid, and so we're trying to intervene and prevent it from going to court or work with the cities and find. And we've found it hard. Now, some cities have said that they will work with the homeowners, but we have worked with cities who are not. So since this affects all cities across the state, we want some consistency in it, clearly laid out for the ones who don't do, as some of these other cities have said that they do, that these are options for them. So basically,
continue your testimony, Ms. Lee.
Yes. So basically what we're saying is the citizens need some kind of a safety net, especially for those who are in poverty, where some of these extra costs and fees and penalties can make them homelessness or can cause them to be homeless. And the other issue I wanted to address in this bill, when they were talking about the different violations that could be specially assessed when they talk about rubbish, weeds, and what's a public health and safety hazard, the trimming of trees, inspections of municipal housing maintenance code. We've had these cases, and it's very unclear. It's open to interpretation of the code enforcement person, and the people need other advocates to intervene and help, mediate in a sense, and that all costs time and money. And then we've also had cases where the city would go in and just feel that they needed to clean up a place. They go in. This happened, I think, with lawn mowing. The person had someone lawn mow the property, but they didn't know that the city came in and authorized some third party to mow the lawn, and so they got specially assessed, and there was no notice of anything. They didn't follow any process, and all of a sudden it's, what is this assessment on the property? And so, and then in another case, the code enforcement person said, why don't you cut down the trees around your house? The homeowner did not know that it was in violation of the code to have down trees in your yard. So when they cut it down, within that week, they got cited for having, dead trees in the yard. And so we have, like I say, different applications and different things happening in the different cities and counties where we need some remedies. The people need clear information. And like I say, if it wasn't for us being advocates out there, they would have not known about any process, not even going to court or the administrative process you talked about. So we're hoping that you will consider offering them that opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lee. Anything else, members? Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Kislishan.
Yes.
Is that
you.
Close?
Thank you.
All right.
Very
I made good. The assertion that there's no due process contained in this legislation. I talked with Mr. Silvey about that. I think he'll do a better job of explaining that. If it is the will of the chair, sure. I'd like to hear him address that issue.
Mr. Silvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Thompson, and members. The list, Section 2 of the bill, it's the list found on lines 1.23 to line 2.15, where it specifically lists some of the charges that can be applied, and we're now adding on line 2.19 these civil penalties. This section dealing with the service charges that can be collected as special assessments, they are subject to the same notice, hearing, and appeal requirements as under current law. So although we're adding another additional item, they would still be noticed to the hearing. They still would be noticed to the advertising of such in the newspaper, and any sort of appeal requirement if someone would be subject to it. So there is a due process in the sense that there's notice, there's hearing, and it wouldn't only limit it to you have an assessment, then you'd have to go to court and fight any sort of charge. There would be this kind of proactive pre-assessment procedure.
Mr. Chairman, if I could respond. Mr. Chairman, I've personally chaired 4 assessment hearings in my time as mayor. What council is referring to is the due process within Chapter 429 for the assessment of the item to the property tax, not the merits of the item. For example, so yes, there is due process under 429, but let me briefly explain what that due process is. The part, let's say we're dealing with a diseased tree. We're dealing with a diseased tree. That is not the issue that's covered under 429 as to whether the diseased tree is really diseased or not. That's not the question before the council. Under 429, the question before the council is the dollar amount charged, is it reasonable for the work that was done? So when I chair an assessment hearing and I've got this huge list of all these different items, that's the question that's before the council, not the question of the merits of why the item is there, just the fact that the dollar amount is there and is it connected. So is the sewer and water bill $200? We're assessing $200. Okay, we move on to the next item. When you're dealing with 429.081 in the appeal to district court, when you appeal at the district court, the question isn't going to be, was the diseased tree really diseased? Did the sidewalk really need shoveling? The question before the court under 429.081 is strictly, is the dollar amount that's being assessed equivalent to the work that was done? That's the question. So when we talk about due process that currently exists in Chapter 429, that's the category of due process. The issue of whether the fine was fair or appropriate, that has no connection to 429. That's why I'm raising the question of, we don't have due process written into this bill addressing the actual core issue of what instigated the fine. Mr. Chairman, thank you.
Before I go to Senator Thompson, I think there's somebody else who wants to testify. Mr. Mielke, if you could step back. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sylvia, is that true? I mean, essentially what Mr. Kislyshyn is saying, if I understand it correctly, is the procedure under the current statute only allows a determination of whether the remedy was appropriate, but you can't address was there a problem, a legitimate problem to be remedied. Is that accurate?
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair and Senator Thompson, I'm a bit confused just with the distinction. I mean, the bill as written would allow the civil penalties or fees imposed be collected. So, I mean, the underlying civil penalty and fee, whatever it may be, I would assume that there would be some sort of process to that was in place to determine what the fee was for and kind of the collection at that point. But in terms of due process, once it's in this list, I mean, it does have that process of notice and hearing. But for the underlying penalty or fee, I guess I wouldn't know what it would be and what the calculation would be because, I mean, it's not specific. It's just property-related violations as it's written.
We're going to hear from one more testifier, then we'll have members' questions, and then we're going to move on to the – identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Grundhofer, General Counsel for the League of Cities. And with due respect to Mr. Kislyshyn, there is abundant due process requirements not only in 429 – but before any city could ever impose any sort of administrative penalty under the 412 provisions that are the first part of this bill, our state and federal constitutions would mandate that any ordinance adopted include sufficient due process. You cannot impose an administrative fine on somebody without a fair amount of due process being in. If you didn't do that, your ordinance would be subject to challenge, any fine would be subject to challenge, and it would be invalid. The second thing I might say is that challenges under 429 in this particular section of the law are subject to reasonableness, and there's plenty of case law to that effect. So if some property owner believes that the administrative fine that might have been imposed is unreasonable in comparison to the violation, the courts are freely able to invalidate that as an unreasonable administrative fine.
Any other questions, members? Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chair, this is a procedural question. Is this bill going to go to judiciary from here?
Not that I'm aware of. I have no request from them. I think it's a tax issue. But what I was going to say is that Senator Carlson, the plan is to lay this over. I would like if the testifiers would leave their contact information with the committee staff. So as we work through this, and Senator Thompson, we will keep you fully informed on any efforts that are going on so you can be involved in that also.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that.
And then we'll see where this goes. We've got a little time in front of us, so let's work on this, Senator Carlson, see if there's some resolution here. Anything else, members?
Mr. Chair, just
Senator Sanjim.
I'd appreciate being, you know, we faced some of these back in city government days, and I was just at a hearing like this in Rochester, I don't know, a couple months ago. They're really difficult, but these issues of due process are really important. I'm not sure I saw it in Rochester a couple of months ago.
Well, Senator Senjum, with your background, maybe we'll keep you in the loop on this.
I'd appreciate that.
Anything else, members? Thank you, Senator Carlson, for bringing this thorny issue to us. Chair will lay Senate file 1595 over for possible inclusion. Anything else, Senator Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senate file 1595 is laid over. Senator Eaton. Welcome, Senator Eaton. Senate file 2581.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill was brought to me by Metro Cities and has the support of my area as well as cities across the state that are planning for their future. Special service districts have been an effective tool for property owners to organize and pay for a higher level of service than the city would typically provide. These services can include snow removal, benches, lighting, and parking, among others. Last year, this committee included an extension in the authority for cities to work with their business owners to create and fund special service districts into 2028. I do have an A2 amendment that clarifies the original bill to define mixed-use buildings. And for more information, I have representatives from Metro Cities and the City of St. Louis Park.
Senator Eaton, I believe we have a delete all amendment. Is this your first committee on this bill? So this is an author's amendment to get the bill into the shape that the author would like. Senator Jensen or Senator Eaton moves the A2 amendment. Is the A2 amendment in everybody's packet? You have it? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senate, the amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape you'd like, Senator Eaton. I think that the Senate Council analyst's handout is to the delete all amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Charlie Vanderardi for Metro Cities, an association of 90 cities across the metro.
Mr. Vanderardi.
Thank you, Senator, Mr. Chairman. As cities look toward their future, they'll be looking to redevelop land. Some of this redevelopment will be mixed-use commercial and residential. Currently, special service districts can only be established in commercial and industrial areas. Senate File 2581 expands the definition of special service districts to allow mixed-use buildings to be included in the districts. Sean Walther from the City of St. Louis Park is here to provide additional information.
Mr. Walther.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, just wanted to briefly talk about St. Louis Park's experience with this and this issue specifically regarding mixed use. We have six districts in the city over three different corridors. Those corridors are predominantly commercial corridors. However, we're seeing an increase in mixed use properties in those areas. And that's both part of the success of the service districts as well as the services that are provided in those commercial areas as people try to get closer to these conveniences so that they're in a walkable area. So we've had specific properties that have redeveloped in these corridors where a service district was established, and we've had some obsolete or smaller commercial properties that had a lot of surface parking that have redeveloped to mixed-use buildings. So a 5,000-square-foot commercial building now has underground parking, 15,000 square feet of commercial, and 44 or 100 units of residential above. And under the current statute, it's not clear that we can assess the commercial, the mixed-use building, because it's as part of that service charge. So we've got an intensification of use. People are drawn to the area, and yet we're losing the number of properties that are able to contribute to the district charges.
Thank you. And Senator Eaton, and to the testifiers, if you could talk to the committee a little bit. As we had discussion last year, as you mentioned, Senator Eaton, about the expansion, the concern is that you end up with different areas of the city having different levels of service depending upon where they live. And we worry about areas or pockets of the city that have more means having a significantly higher level of services. And this is an expansion now to include residential in this mixed use. And could you address the concerns that I just expressed about these level of service differences that result from this?
You want to address that?
Yeah. No, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, as a number of cities have talked to us over our policy committee process and in response to the committee's granting of the extension last year. We wanted to make sure that this wasn't an expansion of mixed-use development where you're looking at blocks and blocks where there's different levels of service where you have, you know, maybe six blocks of residential and then some commercial industrial on maybe a corner property. The intent was mixed-use buildings where you're building up rather than out. So the goal is not to have broad areas where half a city or a whole neighborhood is part of a district with a different level of service, rather looking at vertical buildings, hence the definition change in the, that's proposed in the bill.
And that is clear, that's clear in the definitional changes you're talking about?
I believe so, Mr. Chairman.
That's what the amendment does, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Eaton, thank you. Anything else? Anything, members? Questions? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 2581? Anything else, Senator Eaton?
Mr. Chair, I just
thank you very much. Chair will lay over Senate File 2581 as amended for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Being no other work, the Tax Committee will be meeting on Monday morning at 9 a.m. We will hear the omnibus E12 bill. We're going to take a look at that this afternoon and see how long that is. If it doesn't look like that's going to take very long, we will hear some other members' bills. We'll get that posted as soon as we know. Senator Est.
Mr. Chairman, and the division will be meeting next Wednesday again. So we'll be meeting at least one time next week. I believe the agenda has been sent out to division members.
And just so you can fill out your week next week, the committee will be meeting Tuesday and Thursday also.
At least.
So Monday, Tuesday, Thursday for full committee, division on Wednesday. Thank you all. Committee's adjourned.